Greetings, friends. This talk introduces the fourth week's Truth of Happiness course Dhamma study on the first two factors of the Eightfold Path, right view and right intention. Included at the end of the talk is a 20-minute Shamatha Vipassana meditation session, and this talk concludes with meta-intentional meditation. This talk was recorded in Frenchtown, New Jersey on December 22, 2015. Tonight's talk is on the first two factors of the Eightfold Path, which are called the wisdom factors. The Eightfold Path is divided up into three factors: the wisdom factors, the virtuous factors, and the concentration factors. So tonight is the wisdom factors. And what that means is that they express wisdom, but they're also a way of developing wisdom. So the first factor of the Eightfold Path is right view. And these are the Buddha's words on right view. And what is right view? Knowledge with regard to stress, meaning dukkha. Knowledge with regard to dukkha. Knowledge with regard to the origination of dukkha. So the Buddha is saying right view is developing knowledge of the first and second noble truths right there. Knowledge with regard to the cessation of stress. Knowledge meaning understanding that it's possible and then having the experience of the cessation of dukkha. And then knowledge with regard to the path or practice that develops the cessation of dukkha. And this is called right view. So do you see how right view relates to the entire four noble truths? And the initial right view is a view that these truths make some sense to me. I don't understand them yet, but I'm going to start developing an understanding of the four noble truths. That's the beginning of right view. I usually call it mundane right view. Profound right view is fully incorporating this knowledge. So it's a path of gaining knowledge or wisdom. That's the wisdom aspects. Further on, the Buddha says, and how is right view the forerunner of the Dhamma? One discerns wrong view and right view is right view. That sounds pretty simple and direct, doesn't it? But the problem is that until we have this wider framework of the Eightfold Path, we don't have any way of discerning what's wrong view and what's right view because our minds are so conditioned in going in a certain direction. And anatta, this ego personality, will justify and continually justify wrong view and living a life based on wrong view. And we do that in a lot of ways that I won't get into it. The talk will be too long. But I think we all have justified thoughts and behaviors that we know aren't in our best interest or other people's best interest. We rationalize it away. That's part of that conditioned thinking. And how is right view the forerunner? One discerns wrong view as wrong view and right view as wrong view, as right view. This is one's right view. And what is wrong view? This is really interesting. There is nothing given, There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. Meaning, does that make sense to everybody or anybody? It took me a while to...
Could you read that?
Yeah, I will. Thank you for saying that. Mm-hmm. What is wrong view? There is nothing given, nothing offered, and nothing sacrificed.
This is an older philosophy that was current at the time.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, it relates in a very specific way to the Dhamma. If craving and clinging originate suffering, and clinging means holding on to something, we're not giving up anything. So
seems
what
like
the,
we're giving up a lot.
Pardon me?
Seems like we're giving up a lot.
We're giving up clinging and craving. Yes, you're right, Natalie. It seems like we're giving up everything. Mm-hmm. But what we're doing is letting go of attachments to things. That doesn't mean that that we don't have a life that ongoing when we let go of craving and clinging.
Absolutely. The,
please.
Reading that one more time. Can you just start? Read that one more time.
Oh, I'll read it. I'll read it 10 more times.
Yeah, read that one more time. Because what I did say actually related to a little more clearly. So
what is wrong view? There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. Do you have anything else to say? Because it was such a good comment.
Yeah.
Oh, please.
Well, because nothing is given and nothing is offered, it seems like there's a lot sacrificed within that. To me, because when you're not giving, it seems like you're sacrificing a lot of what you could, all the goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, you're being stingy. you're holding on. That's really I'm glad you brought that up. That's a great understanding of it. And
It's just one perception, I guess.
Ultimately, what it means is that we're not willing to give up the ego personality. When the Buddha described emptiness, he didn't use the word emptiness to describe some mystical void that we should all try to find ourselves in. He said that we should empty the world of ourselves and empty ourselves of clinging. We got to sacrifice something. What do we have to sacrifice? Our clinging views. So let me go on. It'll become even more clear. What is wrong for you? There is no fruit or result of good or bad actions, meaning we're not doing anything that's inclining our minds towards awakening. There is no this world, no next world, no mother, no father, no spontaneously reborn beings, no Brahmins or contemplatives who, faring rightly and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next after having directly known and realized it for themselves. I know that's all confusing, but it gets a little better. So the Buddha here is describing the ignorance and the consequences of wrong view. There is nothing giving, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed means that clinging, craving, desire, and aversion to objects, views, and ideas are maintained. They're not given up. There is no fruit or result of good or bad actions means that there is no understanding of the consequences of delusions. We just continue to live our lives in delusion and confusion, creating suffering and this general unsatisfactory nature to life, and yet we don't understand why it's happening. We don't understand the process.
It also says there's no understanding of karma.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no understanding. We don't understand. Getting back to right view, what's right view? Right view is the beginning of wisdom. Wisdom is understanding. But we have to understand why we're in the situation we're in. We caused it. It's by our own lack of wisdom that has led us to create these lives that are less than satisfying. So there is no fruit or result of good or bad actions. It means that there is no understanding of the consequences of delusion. There is no this world, no next world, no mother, no father, no spontaneously reborn beings, no Brahmins or contemplatives who, faring rightly and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next after having directly known and realized it for themselves, refers to lacking understanding of the process of becoming, comma, and rebirth. We just don't understand it. So once we understand anything, you pick any subject, you develop an understanding of it, it seems pretty simple. The same is true of the Dhamma, but we have to have the experience of generating the understanding. Wrong view is the view that compels one to phenomenal or worldly attainment, acquisition, and attachment. So most everybody on the planet thinks that a life, despite some altruistic things, is also about accumulating things and accumulating possessions and maybe power and those types of things. All of those are based in anicca, they're all impermanent, and they're all subject to an unsatisfactory experience. Initially, wrong view is simply recognized. As right view is developed, actions originating in wrong view are abandoned. It is wrong view that continues to develop karma, and it is wrong view, I should say karma because people think it's not that. It is wrong view that, due to karma, causes rebirth. Wrong view is caused by ignorance. Right view is an expression of wisdom. The Buddha explains how right effort and right mindfulness directly contribute to developing wisdom. One tries to abandon wrong view and enter into right view. This is one's right effort. One is mindful to abandon wrong view and to enter and remain in right view. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus, these three qualities, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness, run in circle around right view. So I'm getting a little bit ahead of ourselves into next week's teaching, but he's explaining how all of these factors of the Eightfold Path mutually support each other, and they're all an aspect of right view, of seeing things clearly. So is that understandable?
Mm-hmm.
No questions about that? Okay.
Just to say, John, I don't think I'm as observant of my mind as everybody else seems to be. Everything is just... No, I kind of get the general direction, but I'm not observant throughout the day of my mind and right view and wrong view and...
I think that takes so much
practice. You know
practice.
What I mean?
Yeah, it does.
Just, and you said right at the beginning that everything runs into each other, falls into each other and supports each other. I don't think it does, but that's what makes it confusing. Because it's not like this is that, that's that, that's that. Everything's like a mush.
I do.
I know the general direction, but I can't pinpoint stuff, which annoys me, actually. I feel like I should be further on understanding what you say than I am.
So, not to contradict you, I would say that you are. from the questions that you've asked in the past and the things you've said, I know that you are, and you're developing a deeper understanding. We talk about insight in the Dhamma, and insight is exactly what you're talking about. You start seeing how these pieces fit together, but at first it is very confusing, only because we haven't had the experience. So first we develop an intellectual understanding. You hear somebody tell you about it, or you read about it, or both. And then hopefully you have a practice that is designed to allow you to develop this understanding. And that's what this whole course is about, and the Dhamma is about that. It's developing this understanding where it was lacking before. That's why that's the difference between wisdom and ignorance. You know, or understanding and ignorance. Remember when I talk about dependent origination states that from ignorance through 12 observable causative links, suffering arises. So, but it's a very specific ignorance. It's ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. And so we're developing that understanding, but it takes a while. You know?
It's just a big cloud there. I'm sure I'm getting it, but not specific. And my thinking through the day, I don't think of specific teachings. I just go in that direction that I think I should be going in. You know, gentle with myself and all what you say, but not clinically thinking about the practice.
Well, I don't know how much thinking, how much analytical thinking is, but I know that you've experienced more mindfulness in your life and a deeper level of concentration. I mean, it's from conversations we've had. And that's really the essence of it. So to have an experience, and in fact, you've told me about experiences where you were mindful of right action and right speech and you engaged in those. And that's really how it works. It works in a very simple and practical way. Our conditioned minds, and this isn't just, you know, specifically to what you just talked about, but our conditioned minds are so complicated, and we're so enamored with ourselves, and we find ourselves very complicated because we create that we have a difficult time with simple answers to this complex problem of me. You know, it seems like it should be much more than this, and it really isn't. It's not that difficult, except we have this conditioned mind, and we have the ego personality insists on continuing to establish itself in every thought, word, object, and event that happens. And so it creates this perception of confusion, which isn't really there, because that helps maintain the ego personality. The more confused I can keep myself, the more I can keep myself. I don't have to change.
That's where I am.
Yeah, and it's not a great place to be, but it's a great understanding to have. That this is just part of the process, this unraveling process, recognizing that, wow, yeah, I am confused about this, but that's not a natural state. Confusion is part of dukkha, it's part of the First Noble Truth. And so if we find ourselves confused in a general way, I'm not talking about just the Dhamma, about our life, it's because of that First Noble Truth and the actions and the results of craving and clinging in our lives.
I have something to say on that.
Please.
When you're speaking about the conditioned mind, so you think it's too much, and like you said, it becomes this mush, this cloud. And when you feel something come up that maybe has habitually hurt you in the past, or just a pattern that keeps arising, we feel it in our minds first, you know, of course, and we think about it, and anything can trigger it, you know. Just a picture or a sense can trigger anything in our mind. When we refuse to let that go right away from the headspace, we send it in other places in our body, like in our heart, you know? Like kind of like in like a kind of chakra way where first, you know, you can't express it because you're so confused by it. So we shove it down into our hearts and then it gets stuck there. And then we start to feel that physically over time when things get triggered again and again, you know, instead of feeling that one specific thing that hurt at one point and we stored it in our mind, it gets, you know, pushed down into our heart, and then we start to feel it in our heart in the future, you know, and it becomes this tightness and this physical quality. And what's been helping me lately is understanding that and trying not to get too caught up in the head and really feeling it where it's actually locating itself in the body. And typically it's in the heart. And breathing into that space and moving it through the heart and letting it go. And there's never going to be a moment that will, you know, necessarily not cause you anguish, because we live in a world of suffering. It's kind of this inevitable, unfortunate thing that we're existing in. But, you know, so we keep having these things that occur. But over time, we learn to let that go a lot quicker, as long as we know where it's manifesting physically, because that has so much to do with what's going on spiritually.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. In week 8, we're going to talk about the 5 clinging aggregates and how through form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and our thought process, we do start attaching ourselves. Another way of saying that is locking these things in our bodies. And it's because of conditioned minds that we have reactions in a certain way that create more upset and create more clinging and craving. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, when we start dismantling this clinging and craving and start deconditioning our conditioned mind, the reaction is no longer there, so we're no longer creating clinging and craving experiences into our body. Anthony explained that really well. He maintained his mind of equanimity. It was a great explanation. Something rather large happened in Anthony's life that could have normally sent a reaction, and it wasn't. Anthony responded with a mind of equanimity,
right.
And so there is no reaction. There's no further cause of suffering or an unsatisfactory nature of life. So ultimately, and this is what the Dhamma is about. It's about developing a mind of lasting peace and equanimity and happiness that's no longer affected by what occurs in the world. We maintain that levelness. And if you want to understand or see an example of it, that's what the Buddha did his whole life. He awakened at the age of 35, and for 45 years he maintained this mind of equanimity. He didn't keep attaching himself to things. He didn't keep having reactionary experiences. And he responded mindfully to life as life occurred, because he was a fully matured, awakened human being. That's what that means. So let me get into right intention before it gets too late. This is just a little bit further on in the sutta, and then I'm just going to talk a little bit more about right intention. In a person of wrong view, wrong resolve or wrong intention comes into being. In a person of wrong resolve, wrong speech. In a person of wrong speech, wrong action. In a person of wrong action, wrong livelihood. In a person of wrong livelihood, wrong effort. In a person of wrong effort, wrong mindfulness. In a person of wrong mindfulness, wrong concentration. In a person of wrong concentration, wrong knowledge. So think about this. This is 2,500 plus years ago. The Buddha is saying these words. There's even a common thing in modern Buddhism that, well, we shouldn't look at wrong things, and that's a dualistic way of looking at it. Well, the Buddha never taught a non-dual Dhamma. That's something that doesn't even make any sense. And he's specifically pointing out that we should recognize when things are wrong, when they're different. We need to be able to recognize it. And he describes very clearly what is wrong and what is right. It's a wrong view or a wrong action if it inclines us to continue with delusion and suffering. And it's a right view and right intention if it starts moving our mindfulness towards awakening, towards release, towards developing lasting equanimity. So the second noble truth is that craving and clinging originates suffering, originates dukkha. So right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon all craving and clinging. That's right intention. And isn't that incredibly simple? I'm not saying it's easy to do. And do you see how it makes sense? That how right view and right intention fit in with the whole broad framework of understanding the Four Noble Truths. Do you see that? Do you see how right intention is the linchpin that this all hangs on? Being willing to recognize clinging and craving so we don't start burying things in our hearts, and abandoning that. Put them aside. Let it go. Let go of craving and clinging. And how do we do it? We do it on a very simple and direct scale. Having incorporated the Eightfold Path into our lives as best we can, we recognize, and we're going to get into this next week, we recognize when we're engaged in wrong speech, wrong action, and wrong livelihood. Because we have a framework and a well-concentrated mind now from meditation to see these things. And not just live our lives from a conditioned response to life. Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Wondering why life is so unsatisfactory. It's because we're living it from the point of view of an ego personality and not from an awakened human being. There was one more point that I wanted to make. So when I revised the book, I started putting tasks related to each factor of the Eightfold Path in a few other places. So the task that's associated with let me read it. The Buddha's words, be mindful of wrong view and enter and remain in right view. And these are my words, and this is the course. This is the task associated with right view. And so the Eightfold Path can be seen as a path of developing very specific skills, so very specific tasks can be accomplished. And this is a perfect example of it. We engage in shamatha vipassana meditation primarily to deepen concentration. And with a well-concentrated mind, we can recognize when we're in wrong view and enter and remain, be mindful of right view. So mindfulness means to hold in mind or to recollect, and both are applicable in this situation. I'm in wrong view. I'm seeing things in a clouded, diluted, stress-inducing way. I'm mindful of this fact, the Eightfold Path, and I recognize it, and I enter and remain, I hold in mind right view. Do you see how that works? Mm-hmm. Very specific and very simple instructions. And then in the broader picture, being able to maintain right view brings clarity to the rest of the Eightfold Path because we're holding in mind the proper context, developing an understanding of dukkha and recognizing craving and clinging. That's the whole Dhamma right there, if we can do that. And then the Buddha taught this Eightfold Path to be able to accomplish this. The task associated with right intention is to recognize, be mindful of when you're in wrong intention, when you're craving and clinging, and enter and remain into right intention, meaning be mindful of abandoning craving and clinging. That's the task associated with right intention. It's pretty clear, isn't it? Pretty simple and pretty direct. We can't do it without a well-concentrated mind, but that's what shamatha vipassana meditation is for. That's why we develop it. So again, I know I say this over and over again, meditation is not to have some kind of experience, a mystical or magical or esoteric experience. It's not really to relax, although the relaxation benefits are wonderful. It's to develop concentration. And why? So we can develop that refined mindfulness that holds in mind the Eightfold Path. Just what you were talking about, Lorna. Mm-hmm. And as, the more we do it, the more we engage in it, the more we'll talk about this next week with right effort. I'm sorry, in week six. The more we engage in this right effort, the more we develop it, the more we develop the understanding. And it's entirely up to us. Nothing is bestowed on us in the Dhamma. You know, we can be the most wonderful person in the world, but if we're not developing the understanding, we're not likely to change our experience in the world. So it's not about gaining merit or gaining benefit or any of that stuff. It's not even about manipulating the physical experience. It's about understanding what's occurring with this refined mindfulness.
Like right view is the compass.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's what keeps our mind inclined in the right direction. Because it's so easy, with conditioned mind, it's so easy to fall back into, you know, our old way of thinking. But again, and concentration comes into that again. We can remain well concentrated. We can keep our minds from getting stuck back in that conditioned way of thinking. Remain here. Remain with what's occurring.
Remain totally present.
Yeah. Right? And that's the point, to be mindful of what's occurring. That's what an awakened human being is. Pardon me?
I'm sorry. I said I get a big hang up on remaining present. And then what? I get stuck in that moment rather than just being like, this is all present, like this ever occurring past, present, future. I mean, it is all now. Instead of just like trying to like pause moments and thinking that's presence.
You can't. It's silly. There's no such thing. The idea of the present moment has become like a new religion. And we're supposed to... What's more agitating than to try to fix yourself in a place where everything is impermanent? You can't. And it flies into the wisdom of the Dhamma. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're not supposed to be fixed in the present moment. We're supposed to be... We're not supposed to be anything. We're supposed to be, it's best to be mindful of life as life occurs, period. There's nothing magical about a present moment because there's no such thing as a present moment. Everything is in a process of becoming. And again, that points back to rebirth and a true understanding of rebirth. If everything is in a process of becoming, including my own understanding, I want to keep my mind pointed in a way that's going to result in a peaceful and happy and equanimous becoming. Rather than something that is leading to more of an unsatisfactory, agitating experience. In every moment of our lives, it's the great secret of the Dhamma. Every moment, every single moment of our lives, we can be inclining our minds towards awakening or continuing delusion. And that's the potential that's in every single moment. What are we going to do with it? Are we going to maintain this well-concentrated mind in the framework of the Eightfold Path? Or are we going to find something more important? And it's okay if you find something more important at times. We're human beings. The middle way, when the Buddha described the middle way, when he described the Eightfold Path, he first said that his path avoids the extreme of extreme asceticism and complete sensory indulgence. His words were, it's a middle way, and that middle way is the Eightfold Path. It allows us to be human beings just as we are, as we develop into fully mature human beings. And because of that, we should never judge ourselves harshly when we fall short of the right aspects of the Eightfold Path. Because that's just part of wrong view and wrong action when we do it anyway. Always be at peace with yourself. Always be gentle with yourselves as you progress. You know, it's a very simple and direct path, but at times it can be difficult. You know, I used to say this more often, but this is a path of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart. So, any questions about... I didn't go too long tonight. Any questions about this talk? So this week you'll read this chapter, week 4, on right view and right intention. We'll talk about that next week before class. And then I'll introduce week 5, which is the virtuous factors, right view, right speech, right action, and right livelihood. These discussions we've been having, I hope I still have time, I've been editing them out of the evening talk and putting them on the website as a separate part of the website, Sangha Q&A, I think I have. And the response I've gotten from online students that are online is just remarkable. I've gotten probably a dozen or so now, maybe even more, of people saying how much they're getting out of our Sangha in the discussion we have here. That they're not able to be part of a Sangha because they're isolated or there's just not a good group around, and they're gaining such great benefit. So, from them, thank you all for that. So let's meditate. Shamatha Vipassana meditation. 8:15. I think we'll meditate, and then I just want to see if there's any more questions before we, and then we'll close with metta. And I have a special metta tonight too. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And holding your back straight but not stiff, ears aligned with your shoulders, nose aligned with your navel, but holding yourself very loosely, very gently, very lovingly. Allow yourselves to settle into this room. Settle onto your cushions. Settle into your bodies and settle into your minds. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just be aware of what that's like. To be mindful of your breath in your body. And while remaining mindful of your breath in your body, notice that thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings, thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of Shamatha Vipassana meditation is to not be distracted by our own thoughts. So when you notice that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. I'll repeat that. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. Putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. And we'll meditate for 20 minutes. aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. Putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. not following a thought with a thought, remaining mindful of our breathing. If a persistent thought or feeling arises, stay with it for a moment or two, recognize it as impermanent, and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. And we'll meditate for 5 more minutes. Take a moment to notice the quality of your mind. Be at peace with your mind. And when you're ready, you could gently open your eyes. So does anyone have any questions or comments before we finish with the meta? Great class. Thank you all. So you understand we'll read week 4 on right view and right intention, and we'll discuss that next week, and then I'll introduce the virtuous factors. So the meta that I often use to close most of our classes is not entirely of my own development, but a lot of the wording and the cadence is my own interpretation of metta. But the Buddha taught metta, and there's two really interesting suttas on that, specifically for what Anthony talked about before. It's about quieting an agitated mind. And the story behind it is very interesting, and I'll do a class on it after this is over. But he taught metta to a group of monks that were very agitated because of things that arose in the forest. Now, I don't want to get into the whole story. But he taught them this way of loving kindness so that their minds would be more calm and they could develop concentration in their meditation practice. Their minds were so agitated they were having trouble sitting. So the Buddha's words, and this is from the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the Buddha's words on loving kindness. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none. The great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. So that's the Buddha's words. And that last line, the Buddha's not talking about the physical experience in this world. He's talking about not giving birth to another distracted and confusing experience in this world, being free of the world of delusion. And it's through this metta, through this practice, that we can develop within this broader framework. And it's just about goodwill and loving kindness. We begin with ourselves, and we end with the whole world. So.
Is that on your website?
It will be. It's not on there yet,
yeah.
But it will be.
It's a good New Year message.
Isn't it? So, thank you all for being here and for a wonderful class. Merry Christmas. Peace. We're done.
I thought I was a week behind.
I was a week behind.
Do you want another talk? I can go on. Are you clear what we're doing?
I got a million of those.
Okay.
Talk about condition.
I thought I had to read chapter 4 to this for now, and I was reading that today.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. It's starting to make a lot more sense, though. Yeah. I don't know. I just feel like empty. The truth just really drilled home. I don't.
Isn't it amazing? And when you get it, it's so simple. How come I didn't see this?
Yeah.
But you've developed enough understanding that you can see it. That's really the point. You can't have the experience of awakening unless you have the total experience. But
yeah.
You're getting it.
The book's great.
Isn't it?
I just want to keep reading. I'm probably going to read chapter 3 again. I'll read it every day for the rest of my life.
Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.